Get back to basics with Judaism 101 with Rabbi Michael Katz.
Hi, it's just gone 11 minutes past 2 on this beautiful Wednesday afternoon after torrential rains just a short while ago here in Joburg, and great to be back in your company, and it's on Judaism 101.9, of course, with Rabbi Michael Katz coming to you live from Joburg, albeit still remotely, broadcasting from the studio in my office, which is no studio at all, but great to be with you and great to be able to share some thoughts with you on this special Erev Rosh Chodesh. Tonight and tomorrow night and the next day, are the days of Rosh Chodesh. Rosh Chodesh being the beginning of a brand new month. And as we have explained before, the beginnings and the ends of our months, according to the lunar calendar, part of the Jewish calendar system, are always celebrated. And they have a great impact on our lives. The idea of a Rosh, the idea of a head that controls, the idea of the head controlling the body, controlling all the organs, everything within it. So too, as we always hear about, the Rosh Hashanah being the day of control, so to speak, of the entire year, Rosh Chodesh has this control over this element of this particular month. And the particular month that we're talking about is not any month at all. It is the month of Adar Hasheni, or Adar, as it would be in a regular year, the month in which not only do we have to increase in joy and happiness, but we also have, right in the middle of the month, in fact, 2 weeks from tonight, we celebrate the Chag, the big festival, the beautiful festival of Purim. And of course, the impact of that is great and wonderful and is felt throughout the month. But tonight is actually the beginning of Rosh Chodesh. It will be the beginning of the 30th day of the month of Adar Rishon. And tomorrow night and the next day will be the first day in the month of Adar Sheni, the second Adar, and the Adar, which is the one that precedes the month of Nisan. And therefore, when Purim comes along, it is exactly a month to go to Pesach. So from today, 6 weeks left before we celebrate Pesach and our true Geula, redemption from Mitzrayim, redemption from Egypt. But let's first focus, if we can, on Rosh Chodesh, because Rosh Chodesh itself is a very, very powerful and important time. Now, there are a number of changes that we make to our tefillot, to our prayers, over the time of Rosh Chodesh. First and foremost, we do not say Tacharun. There are no penitential prayers. Now, penitential prayers are usually not said on days of Simcha, on days of joy. As we know, we don't say penitential prayers, Tacharun, at a wedding or a day of a bris, and so on. We also do not say those penitential prayers, those Tachanun prayers, are not said on the Chagim, on the Yomim Tovim, but we also don't say them on some of the sadder days, on the days like Tisha B'Av, or a mourner during the week of Shiva does not say Tachanun, does not say those penitential prayers. You do not say them in a house of mourning and so on. So there is something about them being completely inward focused, I think, the idea of actually at times having to defer to not only the greater good, but having to look at the level of simcha within the community and having to defer to that is one of the underlying rules behind the saying of Tachanun. It is something of a communal behavior that is dictated by the simcha, by the joy. And certainly when it comes to the days of Rosh Chodesh, where tonight and tomorrow night and the next day are Rosh Chodesh, we too do not say Tachanun. We're focused on the simcha that this time heralds, rather than focusing just inwardly, just focusing on ourselves and our own penitence or our own gaining of exoneration from the Almighty. Now, we therefore take a look at the day before. Erev Rosh Chodesh usually does have an element of that kind of penance, of an opportunity to repent, to say that we're sorry. It's sometimes the day before Rosh Chodesh is called Yom Kippur Katan, a little Yom Kippur. There are many people who fast on such a day. But the days of Rosh Chodesh lift that all, change that all, and make them into days of Simcha. And how much more so when we're talking about the transitional time between Adar Rishon and Adar Sheni, the first Adar and the second Adar. It's this junction point between Adar 1 and Adar 2. It's a time when we need to doubly perhaps increase in our joy, or perhaps to look at joy from a slightly different perspective, and perhaps to focus on the pending, coming up, beautiful Chag, the beautiful festival of Purim, time of great and wonderful miracles, great and wonderful things that happened for the Jewish people. Now, when we focus on the idea of Rosh Chodesh, in addition to the fact that we do not say Tachanun, we also do add in Hallel. We say Hallel. We say the prayers of great joy and euphoria over our relationship with the Almighty, the Hallel prayers, praising God for all the wonderful things that He has done for us. And this happens on all of the Chagim, all of the special festive occasions, as well as on Rosh Chodesh. And in addition to Hallel, we also say a Musaf prayer. We pray the additional services, which are said on the first and the second days of Rosh Chodesh. So both Thursday and Friday, we'll be saying those special Musaf prayers because of the Musaf, the additional offering that was brought in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple. In temple times, an additional offering brought for the Chagim, for the festivals, and of course, for this Chag, this festival of Rosh Chodesh. So it's a great time, and it's a time, if we think about the idea of an extra sacrifice being brought in the Beit HaMikdash, it's an extra opportunity to connect, an extra time to feel a little closer to the Almighty, an extra time to focus on what Rosh Chodesh actually is all about, heralding and announcing the arrival of a new lease on life, of a new opportunity, particularly with this month of joy, of simcha, of a positive outlook, of looking at things in a positive frame of mind rather than in a negative one, which unfortunately seems to sometimes dominate us just a little bit too much.
Get back to basics with Judaism 101 with Rabbi Michael Katz.
We're continuing our discussion about the Rosh Chodesh and the upcoming month of Adar Sheni. And perhaps here we'll shift our focus a little bit to the Chag, to the special festival of Purim, about which there is so much that can be said. But I'd like to focus our attention in the preparation for Purim now, 2 weeks before. Let's think about where this festival actually fits into the Jewish calendar in a spiritual sense, what its deeper significance and meaning is actually all about, and how perhaps it can and should have a great and important bearing on our lives and on events of the last few days and events in a crazy world, in a time when things once again seem to be a little uncertain, where there are people fighting wars, which we kind of thought, I certainly felt, that we'd reached a level whereby war was no longer going to be a means of sorting out differences or problems or issues. But it seems that other people have different ideas. It seems to be very, very last century kind of thinking, or before that, to actually have to go to war. Thought we had moved away from that. But be that as it may, let's think about, is there a message within Purim that we could perhaps bring to bear to reflect upon and to think about what is actually going on in our lives and in the world per se? Let's begin by just thinking back to the structure of the Jewish calendar. And I'm not going to go into the details of everything to do with the Jewish calendar, but just one point that I would like to make, and that is that Pesach comes at the beginning of the cycle of festivals of that particular year. And the whole group of festivals, right the way up until Simchat Torah, are actually one block. It moves together from the first day of Pesach until Simchat Torah is a set number of days. It is exactly the same. It works on the same grid. Year after year after year, it always will be, it always has been exactly like that. If we just pause for a moment and think what that actually means, well, just think about this. The first night of Pesach, the 14th of Nisan. So the 15th of Nisan is the beginning of Pesach. The second night of Pesach, we start to count the Omer, Sfirat HaOmer. We count 49 days, and on the 50th day is Shavuot. That is always like that. So Pesach, from the beginning until Shavuot, which is 7 weeks later, is an exact number of days. It fits exactly onto the same grid every single year. We then go from Shavuot through to Yom Kippur is 120 days. How do we know that? It's because Moshe Rabbeinu went up the mountain and was up there for 40 days and 40 nights. He then spent 40 days and 40 nights after he broke the first set of tablets in trying to gain exoneration, tshuva, for the Jewish people. He then ascended the mountain again on Rosh Chodesh Elul to come back down with the second set of tablets on Yom Kippur, which was a 40-day and 40-night period later. So you've got 120 days from Shavuot to Yom Kippur. Rosh Hashanah is always exactly 10 days before Yom Kippur. It's the first and the second of the month, Yom Kippur the 10th of Tishrei. We then have a four-day gap after Yom Kippur to Sukkot, and Sukkot, of course, is always 7 days, and then the day of Shmini Atzeret, the 8th day, and the 9th day being Simchat Torah. If we haven't proved that point there, well, I think you need to just look at it and understand that from the first day of Pesach until Simchat Torah is a set grid. The first day of Pesach will kind of dictate a tremendous amount about every festival, every chag that follows on thereafter. And this is probably why when God gives us the instruction of HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem, that this should be the first of your months, when we come to the Shabbat preceding Rosh Chodesh or on Rosh Chodesh Nisan, that we read that first instruction to the Jewish people about having to have a calendar that runs according to the moon and, of course, takes into account the seasons when it comes to Pesach as well, that it was that month and the month in which Pesach occurs that has to set the tone for the rest of the year. Now, there are two chagim, two festivals, that were not included between Pesach and Simchat Torah, if we take all of the chagim together. And those are, of course, Purim and Chanukah. Chanukah, which we celebrated a number of weeks ago, which always occurs in this part of the world in the summer. It's usually a December-based festival. That festival of Chanukah is a festival that was added later. And when I say later, it's not defined directly in the Torah itself, that on this day you should do this and do that and bring offerings and so on. That is Chanukah, the 8 days of candle lighting, which takes place in December. And of course, what it commemorates is something that was post-biblical era as well, because we were talking about the time of the temple with the menorah that burnt for 8 days instead of the one, and so on, and the triumph of the Maccabees at the time over the Assyrian Greeks, who wanted to bring about their influence and destruction in Eretz Yisrael and the land of Israel, and to the Beit HaMikdash, to the temple. So when we think about Chanukah, it falls out of that ambit. And when we think about Purim, Purim itself falls out of that ambit as well, because Purim took place much later as well. It took place actually between the two Bate Mikdash, between the two temples, and that was with the story of Ahasuerus and Haman and Mordechai and so on. And of course, it took place in Persia, it took place in Babylon, time of the Babylonian exile, and just before we had permission to actually go back and begin the construction of the Beit HaMikdash Hasheni, the second temple. So both of these festivals, Chanukah and Purim, fall out of that definite grid, that definite framework. But when it comes to Purim, we're told that Purim needs to be exactly 1 month before Pesach. The way that it's expressed by our sages in the Talmud is Nismach Geula LeGeula. It comes in the discussion about if Purim should be in the first or the second Adar. It's made very clear that it needs to be in the second one. It needs to be close to Pesach. Why? Because there are two different kinds of Geula, two different kinds of redemption that Purim and Pesach in turn speak about, or that they involve themselves with, or that they are reflective of. And there is the idea of having them follow one another only a month apart. And so Purim will occur on the 14th of Adar, Pesach on the 14th and 15th of Nisan, and that needs to be 1 month apart. And then we get our idea of Purim being in the second of these months. So in a sense, Purim too has a link to Pesach as well, and has a link therefore to this grid that I was talking about. Chanukah is the one that's a little bit loose in that sense. It actually can end on different dates even in the calendar, because in the middle of Chanukah is Rosh Chodesh, where there can be 1 or 2 days of Rosh Chodesh, the months of Cheshvan and Kislev, where there can sometimes be an extra date, an extra day, and therefore it is not always exactly the same distance, sometimes a day out in distance from Pesach, and therefore it's kind of more of a free range type of a chag, Chanukah, that happens in December, as we said. But if we think about these two festivals, both of them that came to us and were instituted as festivals, chagim, that the Jewish people celebrate and we always have since their occurrence, they both focus, or they, the two of them focus on some things that are very different. Yes, both of them, we see a similar kind of a theme, that there was a group of people or a nation or an individual who wanted to destroy the Jewish people and wanted to destroy something is absolutely essential to an understanding of the difference between Chanukah and Purim and what they commemorate, what we think about when we think about Chanukah and Purim. Chanukah, which, as we said, occurred during the time of the Assyrian Greeks, and the story of Chanukah taking place as it did with the Beit HaMikdash, that still had a connection to the temple in a direct way. Purim happened outside of Israel, in the diaspora. It happened in Babylon, the whole story of Purim. But there is something more important, and that is, when it came to the Assyrian Greeks, the story of Chanukah, what they wanted to do was they wanted to take away the soul of the Jewish people. They were bent on the destruction of the spirituality of Judaism. The Assyrian Greeks wanted to make everything down to earth and rational and logical and beautify and glorify the body, the material world, the physical. That was the focus of the Assyrian Greeks. They didn't want, or they defied, or they said there was, it was nonsense when we think about, or we talk about things of miraculous nature, when we think about things of a godly nature. They said, no, everything is down to earth. It's physical. You're here. This is your life. The time that you're born and the time that you die, that defines it all. And it's all about the physical pleasures, physical enjoyment, physical prowess, physical strength, and so on. That is actually what the Assyrian Greeks wanted to try and assert. And it was the triumph over that, a proof of the fact that the menorah burnt for the 8 days, a proof of the fact that the few could triumph over the many, because we had God on our side. This was the counterbalance, or the counteraction to what it was that the Assyrian Greeks wanted to assert. When it came to Purim, Haman and his ilk wanted to destroy the bodies of the Jewish people. They wanted to destroy us physically. And if we think about it, then it is actually a very, very physical kind of a festival that we celebrate on Purim. We are celebrating the fact that our bodies, that our physical, was not destroyed. They threatened us, Haman and his people, the Persians. There was a threat against our physical well-being. They wanted us to die. They did not want Jews to live. They wanted to carry out a mass murder. They wanted to carry out a Holocaust. They wanted to see to the complete destruction of and wiping off the face of the map of the Jewish people, wherever they may be. This was what they were bent on. And so our celebration and our commemoration is hardly one that is very spiritual, other than the spiritual things that we imbibe, that we drink in order to get us into the state that we're told to be in on Purim, which is Adalo Yado, where we do reach a level whereby we don't know the difference between cursed is Haman and blessed is Mordechai. We have a much more down-to-earth, a much more physical way of celebrating. Think about it. We celebrate by eating a meal. We celebrate by drinking. We celebrate by giving food gifts to others. We give physical money to other people. We make sure that all of those things that are done on Purim are actually very, very physical. And it's fascinating when we think about, and we go just a little deeper, and we think about what it actually was that the Assyrian Greeks were trying to assert, and what that chag, what that festival actually is truly all about when we think about Hanukkah, and what the Persians were trying to assert when we think about an Haman, trying to assert when we think about Purim. Well, let's perhaps phrase it in the following way. When it comes to Hanukkah, the festival of Hanukkah was all about the Assyrian Greeks telling us that rational thinking is the most important thing. Logic, being absolutely down to earth, understanding how science operates, seeing to the power and the strength of the physical, of the material world. This is actually what they wanted to assert. It was based in good, logical, scientific thinking, rather than what they perceived to be nonsense, the idea of there being a spiritual world, the idea of there being a soul, the idea of there being miracles. That was what their focus was on. The focus of the Assyrian Greeks was to kind of bring us down to earth, make us rational, logical, physical creatures, physical human beings, kind of wipe out of our frame of reference anything that had to do with anything of the spirit, of the neshama, of the soul. This was actually the thought of the Assyrian Greeks. When it comes to Purim and it comes to the story of Haman, Haman and his ilk went a little bit different. If we think about the very name of this festival, it's called Purim. Purim is lots. What did Haman do? He was so caught up with the destruction of the Jewish people that he wanted to get into the realm of, let's call it, the madness. He wanted to reach even higher than the logical. They say, you know what, logic is not going to be good enough here. I want to try and get an image or a vision of the fact that even beyond and above logical, even when we go into the realm of craziness, when we go into the realm of the illogical, when we go into the realm of what we would call today random, the randomness of everything, that was where Haman wanted to spend his time, focusing on getting that kind of a realm to dictate that the Jewish people should be destroyed. This is what he did. He drew lots to try and prove in a way that even the random, never mind the logical, but even the random is on his side. And he thought that he got there, and he almost did, except for the fact that he made a great, great, great miscalculation. And we'll talk about that when we come back.
Get back to basics with Judaism 101 with Rabbi Michael Katz.
We've been talking about Purim and Hanukkah and the Chagim and how they all line up and how they all convey a kind of a different message, talking to our spiritual selves. And let's think about the idea that Purim is called Purim, which means lots or lotteries. Now, there are many people who would say that life is a lottery. There are many people who would say that, you know, it's everything is random. From a Torah perspective, from a Jewish point of view, it is the very antithesis of that. There is nothing random in God's world. There is nothing random in everything that Hashem does or allows to happen. If we look at things and we think of them as being random, that randomness is something that is really conveyed by the name of this festival, Purim. When it came to Hanukkah, there was the logic. There was the idea of getting everybody to be down-to-earth, rational, thinking, material, physical people. When it came to Purim, Haman tried to elicit the spiritual worlds to try and convey his obscene kind of a down-to-earth message of the fact that a certain people, namely the Jewish people, needed to be wiped out. And there was the serious backfire on Haman when it came to his drawing of those lots, because he was so excited when he picked out the lot, saying that it would be in the month of Adar that the destruction of the Jewish people would be decreed and would actually come into force, because he saw that God, so to speak, was on his side. Look at the, even the random world is coming to the fore here. The randomness of the lottery that he drew told him that the month of Adar was the time when Moshe Rabbeinu, when Moses died. And because Moses died in that month, so the greatest Jewish leaders lost in that time. Of course, it's got to be a really, really sad time. The Jewish people are now abandoned by God, clearly. And it's happening at the same time. Their abandonment by God is happening at exactly the same time that he, so to speak, abandoned them with the loss of Moshe Rabbeinu, of Moses in the desert. What he failed to recognize, say our sages, is of course that Moshe was born in the month of Adar as well, and that the Jewish people do not focus on the death of Moshe Rabbeinu as being an end, but rather a beginning, the beginning of our advent to the land of Israel, the beginning of the leadership of Yeshua, and the fact that Moshe Rabbeinu remained in the desert in order to lead his people back when Mashiach comes was just another part of that same story. So the idea of Purim was something that Haman wanted to use, that he and his ilk wanted to use to prove that the randomness of the world would also dictate that the Jewish people needed to be destroyed. And what a miscalculation he made. Why? Because there is nothing random. Because the same way as God wanted the Jewish people to receive the Torah at Mount Sinai, God wanted the Jewish people to understand and to know and to be the living proof of the fact that everything is by God's divine plan rather than there being a randomness to it at all. Be back with you right after this.
Get back to basics with Judaism 101 with Rabbi Michael Katz.
So as we align our lives with a Rosh Chodesh, which is about to begin this evening, and we think about the terrible threats against lives in a part of the world that is distant from us geographically, but close to us because there are hundreds of thousands of Jewish people who at this moment are under threat in the Ukraine and that part of the world. And our thoughts and prayers are certainly with them at this difficult time. And we think about Am Yisrael Chai, of the Jewish people, living and flourishing and being united. And therefore, as we pray and as we give tzedakah on their behalf and as we learn Torah on their behalf, let's think about the fact that there is actually nothing random in God's world. The fact that the negative things happen, and hopefully very, very soon, the positivity. We hope and pray that we're going to look at this as another Adar and Purim miraculous time rather than a time of negativity, God forbid, or a time of difficulty on any level whatsoever. Let's hope and pray that very, very soon we see what we are supposed to see by this festival of Purim. Purim meaning lottery. There is nothing random. The randomness that the festival of Purim instructs us and wants us to tap into is that we are all very, very well equipped to understand that when great miracles, where wonderful things happen, and where things go swimmingly, where everything goes perfectly, that of course God is on our side. But what we are not that well equipped to understand is the fact that when there seem to be things that are random, where there seem to be things that are not that well coordinated or that well organized, where things don't go actually as we have over the last few years really seen, according to plan, where plans are changed at the last minute, that there is nothing random about that either. There is nothing random, in fact, in this world. The fact that, as our sages have taught us, that a leaf falls in a particular spot from a tree, that too is not random. It is by design. And that God's design for this world goes far, far, far deeper than we could ever have imagined. We can imagine, we can think about it being in our choices of who we marry or where we live or what we do for a living and so on. We can think about that as being all part of this great design. But when random, so-called accidental, incidental things happen, it's not so easy to see. The festival of Purim tells us, be happy and be satisfied and rest assured that even the things that we perceive to be random are not random at all. It's all part of God's design. And the same way as God allowed, enabled, sad and difficult and tough and stressful things to take place, he also is the one who very, very soon will see to the geula, the redemption. May it come speedily in our time, not only for those who are in a position of threat and of difficulty at this on this particular day, but may it please God come for all of us in the same way as everything was turned around in the festival of Purim, and that the days of sadness or the days of stress and the days on which we thought we were going to be destroyed became the days of our greatest success, the days of our greatest joy and happiness. And please God, that will happen for all of us very, very soon with the coming of Mashiach immediately. It's been great chatting with you this afternoon. I look forward to being back with you, please God, in the very near future on another exciting episode of Judaism 101.9.